Welcome back to Jim Brown's Outrig Capercast. This is number 17, and I'd like to talk about the modern proa. P-R-O-A, that is, that's the word we use to describe the Micronesian canoe, or the single outrigger shunting canoe. As discussed in number 16, that means that this vessel cannot tack, it shunts. It has to keep its single outrigger side always facing the wind. Now, I realize that without a lot of pictures and drawings and so forth, that's going to be very difficult to understand. It was very difficult to me, I'll tell you, when I first became introduced to proas by my son Russell, who, as a young man, got interested in the type as a result of reading Dick Newick's book, Project Cheers. And incidentally, Russell and his wife Ashlyn have recently republished that book. It's available from ptwatercraft.com. PT as in Port Townsend Watercraft. It's a real gem of lightweight seafaring history. But for our purpose here, we're going to have to leave a lot out and fast forward to my first experience offshore with Russell in his proa named Kauri. K-A-U-R-I, after the New Zealand wood from which part of it was built. One day I received a phone call from Russell. He was out in Bermuda. He had sailed his proa up from the Caribbean, single-handing, as I recall, but now he said, "Hey, gee, Dad, it's been a long time since you and I had a good old sailboat ride together. Why don't you come on out here and help me sail from Bermuda up to Martha's Vineyard, New England?" And my first reaction was, "Huh? Who, me?" I didn't understand his boats. They were the most outlandish, off-the-wall contraptions I had ever heard of. I had never really gotten interested in them. And the very thought of going out in the ocean in the darn things, I mean, I was honestly scared. I had this big lump in my throat that made it difficult for me to respond. It took a few seconds for me to figure out, hey, this is a request to which one does not say no. So, biting my lip, I flew to Bermuda. We spent a couple of days knocking around, getting prepared, watching the weather, and one fine day took off, heading north. Well, the first thing I noticed was that it had indeed been a long time since Russell and I had sailed together. He was no longer in his early teens. He was now 24, and he had put together an extremely sophisticated vessel. She loped along, just a wonderful, quiet, dry canter in fair winds in the open sea. Her hulls were so very narrow that she did not get kicked around by the crest. She would just slice right over the top of them and keep going. The breeze was a little north of west, and we were going north, and we knew that we were going to be swept by the Gulf Stream to the east, and so we put the vessel up on the wind for a while, and oh my, I was really pleased with how very close-winded she was, probably as a result of the headstay not being directly forward of the mast. In fact, the mast is stepped on the platform, not on the main hull, but out to windward of the main hull on the platform, and this opened up a nice big slot between the mainsail, which was on a rotating mast, a big full batten, very efficient modern mainsail, and the Genoa, which was now really drawing to its maximum efficiency and without backwinding the mainsail. So we sailed on through the afternoon like that, and about dinner time I went below to fix us something to eat, and I was quite surprised at the quiet and smoothness of the ride down below. And while we took our dinner, I remarked to Russell at what a marvelous sea boat he had contrived here. And I asked him why he had never offered plans to other builders for a vessel like this. And he said, "Oh, gee, Dad, I don't think I want anybody else to have a boat like mine." But I realized that he had seen what I had been through in trying to service a clientele who really knew very little of seafaring and was trying to build seafaring boats from my plans. It's very involved. The consultation part of it, particularly for a proa, would have been, you know, a real chaos situation for us. And I think that's why he has always been rather reticent to consult for others on proa design, unless they were already experienced builders with lots of sea time. Well, at dusk, the wind backed into the west and laid down a little bit, and we sailed off into the night. And sometime later during my watch, the wind died completely. Russell was sound asleep, and then a breeze settled in from the southeast, and that meant, of course, that I had to figure out how to shunt in the dark. I tried just going by the book, you know, slack the main sheet, then drop the jib, and put the boat right across the wind, and turned so as she lies with the outrigger, of course, on the windward side. Put both board rudders in the down position, of course one, the then rudder, was already down. And now the boat was effectively parked, dead in the water. I could leave the cockpit with security, go up on the then bow and secure the then headsail, go to the now bow, prepare the now headsail for hoisting, go back to the cockpit, pull up the then rudder, now in the forward end of the boat being unused, pull in on the main sheet, drag the boom around to the now stern, sheet in the headsail on the now bow, and take off on the new course. Oh, my, I was so proud of myself. Now, the cockpit resembles a double sidecar in a motorcycle, that is, where two passengers would face each other. I went to the now end of the cockpit, grabbed the now whipstaff, not a tiller, but a whipstaff that operates fore and aft instead of side to side, and plugged myself in, sort of trying to figure out which way to pull or push on the whipstaff in order to get the boat to go right or left. Well, if it didn't go the right way the first time, you'd push instead of pull. Anyway, off I went into the night, and Russell, who had been listening to the whole thing, cracked the hatch open a little bit, stuck his head up, and said, "All right, Dad, you got it going." Well, we went along like that till after breakfast, when the wind began to veer around to the stern. We were running in a gentle breeze, just knocking out the miles, having a good time. But the wind kept clocking on around behind us, and that meant that we had to shunt again. And that's sort of the same thing going downwind, but Russell's old friend Mark Baylog says it's like driving down the street, pulling into the driveway, backing out of the driveway, and continuing down the street backwards in the same direction you were going. I was quite befuddled by that operation. Glad I didn't have to learn that one in the dark. And we just loped along on a delightful canter into our second night a sea. And so far the whole trip had been made with overcast skies. We were unable to get a shot at the sun or at any other celestial body in order to kind of figure out where in the world we were going. Russ relieved me about midnight. The wind was light, and it commenced to rain. I had a good sleep, and the rain knocked the sea down, so the boat was really quite comfortable. But every time I woke up, I realized that it was really dumping rain, and poor Russ was out there in the cockpit, you know, hiding under his slicker. And he was supposed to wake me up about 4, but he decided to hang on until daylight. So I had a really good rest, but it was plain at breakfast time that he was tired. Now the rain let up as I took over, and I was intent on giving him a good rest too. But about 10 minutes after the poor guy crawled into the sack, the wind came in suddenly from the east. And of course the Gulf Stream was headed east, and so it got choppy pretty fast. And then we had a astronomical sudden increase in wind force. We did not have to shunt. We were reaching, the boat really trucking. And, of course, here came Russ bounding out of the hatch in his underwear. "Hey," I shouted, "don't you want to get your fowlies on?" No, he wanted to get sail down now. Now, he had both halyards arranged in rope clutches on the masts for immediate release, so he immediately released the headsail halyard. And I released the sheet, and he started forward to pull the sail down. It was flogging madly, and he turned and hollered at me, "Park it, Dad! Park it!" So I dumped the mainsail sheet. The boom swung out straight downwind over the downwind side of the vessel, And the next thing I knew, we were stopped dead and under complete control to move off in either direction. I realized at that moment how valuable it was to be able to park a proa. We could stop the boat. If he had gone overboard, out there on the bow trying to get a big jib down, and the boat racing through the water, I never would have found him. But as it was now, we could both go for a swim if we felt like it. So he bundled up the jib and lashed it down securely, and then we dropped the main. And that sail came down like a ton of bricks into its lazy jacks. We pulled in the main boom, got stops on the sail, and then, to my surprise, Russell lowered the boom down its track so that the whole boom and sail was on deck, where he lashed it securely, and it lay right alongside the cockpit. Meantime, the wind was picking up, the waves were getting steep, and they were falling down their faces, maybe blowing a little of the tops off. We had a discussion in the cockpit, and the next thing he did was to put some water in the outrigger hull. He had a big diaphragm pump in the cockpit into which he could pump water into the ballast tank in the outer hull. 1 gallon per stroke on that pump. And even with no sail up, we could feel the boat settle down. Now we looked around and decided we could keep going, so we put up a little scrap of storm jib. And the next thing I knew, we were underway again at speeds, well, somewhere in the low teens, sailing right across the wind and down the valleys of the waves. And he clued me in on how to steer by looking ahead and deciding which way I wanted to go around waves that were approaching. I could decide to push on the whip staff, head the boat up, let the wave go ahead, and steer across its back, or if it looked really angry, I could pull on the whip staff, bear off, and catch the wave and surf like a scalded dog, and let the darn thing just expend itself behind me. And of course, being in the Gulf Stream, at times like this, we were concerned about the possibility of really big waves, perhaps a rogue wave. And he emphasized that if I saw a really big one coming and it looked like it was going to hit us, that I should have no confusion at that time, pull on the whipstaff to bear off and run before the wave. At that point, he opened the deck hatch, dropped down below, and said good night. And I don't think I had ever felt quite so on my own at sea. I swear it must have been maybe 5 minutes later. I don't think Russell had even had a chance to get dried off and changed before crawling into bed when I heard a freight train approaching from the east. It was a giant roar. I'm not sure even what the wave looked like today. I was mostly concerned with pulling on that whipstaff, which I did. The boat bared off abruptly, and I felt the stern going up the elevator, and the boat took off like I can't believe the sensation of going so fast that a fire hose of spray hit me in the front with such force that my left arm, which was wrapped around the sail in the boom, was sore for days afterwards. My right arm, hanging onto the whipstaff and facing forward, had water blasted up my sleeve to the point where I felt it pouring out at the neck. Of course, I couldn't see a thing, but the next thing I remember was from being inundated from behind. I knew the boat was headed down the wave, but I also knew that if I kept the whipstaff pulled aft any longer, that the boat was going to try to jibe and broach, which under the circumstances, of course, could have led to a capsize that is foundering in the wave. So without being able to see a thing, I bit my tongue and straightened up on the whipstaff. All of a sudden, the boat popped out of the wave. She had caught it. There was water pouring off of the deck on all sides, and we surfed that wave like I can never describe. I'm sure the speed was briefly up into the 20s, and when we finally began to level out and slow down, I heard Russell laughing. I looked and he had cracked the hatch just enough to look out with bright eyes, and he said, "I bet it's been a long time since you surfed a wave like that." The hatch closed and he was gone. And at that point, I realized my glasses were gone, and I began to get angry, and I said, "You son of a bitch! I've never surfed a wave like that, and I hope I never do again." I guess about that time I realized we were headed for New Jersey instead of for Cape Cod. So I put the boat up on a reach, and she began to range ahead again at alarming speed, but all at once I realized the steering was wonderfully crisp, and I really wanted my glasses to be able to see ahead. I started feeling around. Of course, that first blast had knocked my hood back, and I found my glasses in my hood. I cleaned them with my lips and tongue, which incidentally is a good way to clean glasses when the spray is flying. I was soaking wet, but it was warm Gulf Stream water. I felt like I was sitting in a giant puddle of piss. My left arm began to ache from gripping the boom, and as I began to get the hang of steering away from or up behind these oncoming waves, which by now were, spectacular, but the boat was so easy to direct that I began to relax a bit and really enjoy this ride. The boat felt like it was glued to the road, and I just had a great time for the next 5 hours steering that boat across the North Atlantic. I'll never forget the experience. It only lasted about 5 hours. Mercifully, the wind let down, and off we went for Cape Cod under more normal circumstances. It might have been late that afternoon or maybe the next morning that Russell spotted a sail up ahead on the horizon. He asked me to try to raise it on the radio, our VHF, which I was unable to do. I mean, we were both out in the wide open, no reason really to be listening to the VHF. But because we had gone so long without a sight, we were really fairly well lost out there. So Russ decided to sheet up and sail on up there and try to attract that guy's attention. He was going the same direction we were. Russell suspected that it was one of those yachts that had left Bermuda the day before we had. And we knew that at the time many yachts carry some kind of electronic navigation, LORAN or SatNav. So Russell was really hoping to get a position off of this neighbor of ours out on the big blue briny. So we overhauled that boat, and we could see a single figure in the cockpit, all huddled in his slicker, staring down at the compass. And so as we approached, Russell said, "Hey, Dad, why don't you get out on the float there, and as we go by, we'll give him a little show, okay?" Well, I could guess what he had in mind. As we crossed over courses with that boat, Russell pulled the sheet in and picked up the float on which I was riding. I must have been 5 or 6 feet up in the air when we went by, and I gave the guy a shrill whistle. And the poor guy jumped like he'd been stuck with a hat pin. He whirled around and saw us going by, big eyes. And as I flew practically right over him, I put my fist up to my ear and hollered, "Radio!" And Russell slacked the sheet, and the float that I was riding on came whomping down in the ocean. And I took the helm, and Russell went down to talk with him and turned the volume up, and I could hear coming through the hull, "Flying Proa, Flying Proa, this is the yacht Pinocchio, blah, bitty, blah, blah. You guys really gave me a start." Well, he gave us a position, which we greatly appreciated, for we were able to set a course for our eventual landfall at Block Island. I will never forget that trip, for it brings to mind that old adage about how we shall learn from our children.
Hey, folks. There's more to this story, but as usual, the geezer has talked himself out of time, and he left out of the father and son aspects of making such a passage, and more about what a proa really is. If you would like to read the whole thing, and you can borrow the book, it's in volume 2 of his memoir, Among the Multihulls, chapter 17. And if you cannot find the book, it's available on Amazon. You won't forget how they run out of gas in a calm, just yards from the harbor mouth, and Russell tows the proa with his kayak into the harbor right past the snooty monohullers who had passed them by, refusing to give them a tow. Really, if you can stand his capers, you might actually like his books. Merry Christmas.